It'd be really weird if I just stood here and just didn't say anything, hey? I'm not going to do that. I did it for a little bit right there, and it just felt really weird. How many of you guys have noticed I always wear green when I preach? What if I stopped doing that? You guys know I preached. I'm going to do that next week and see if you guys notice. Shocking. So you just said shocking. Blow my mind. Anyways, I named my sermon. It's called Monument Part 1. That means I get to preach on the second part next week. So that means you guys got to come back for next week to figure out the whole story. You know, a little cliffhanger there like they do with the whole seasons on TV. They're like, dun-dun-dun, to be continued. I got to wait 4 months now. Kidding. You get it next week, not 4 months. Anyways, so I named it Monument, and this, hopefully my sermon tells you why I named it Monument. There's a classic hymn that many of you guys would know. I haven't sang it for a while, but we actually get to sing it today. And it's called, Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing. Now, what is particular about this hymn and why I've chosen to add it into my sermon is that there's a key word in one of the verses. In the second verse, it reads this, Here I raise mine Ebenezer, hither by the help I'm come, and I hope by thy good pleasure safely to arrive at home. Jesus sought me when a stranger, wandering from the fold of gold, He too rescued me from danger, interposed his precious blood. The key word I'm taking from that verse is, of course, Ebenezer. But how many of you guys, when I say Ebenezer, automatically think of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol? Yeah, it's hard not to. I thought of that too, because Ebenezer is the name of the old man, grumpy old man, who really hates Christmas and he despises anyone else who loves it. But when I thought of that, I automatically thought of A Muppet's Christmas Carol, which, okay, this is, my head trails off, but it's funny because I think of Beaker. Do you guys know who Beaker is? He's like the skinny puppet thing with crazy hair, and he's like, me, 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 the whole time. And it's just funny because he's interacting with Scrooge to get some money, and it doesn't work out. Anyways, so that's what I thought about when I thought of Ebenezer. I thought of A Christmas Carol, which turned into a Muppet Christmas Carol, which turned into Beaker, and just me, 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 the whole time. So rabbit trailed really bad there. Anyways, but do you guys know what Ebenezer means? No cheating, no cell phones or anything. I'll eventually tell you that. But the cool thing is, Ebenezer is not only the name of an old man in A Christmas Carol, but it's also a name which you can find in the Bible. But it's not a name of a person. And you can find this in 1 Samuel chapter 7. I'm going to give you the short form of it. This is not necessarily part of my sermon. Well, it is part of my sermon, but it gives explanation of Ebenezer. I wish I wouldn't talk like this. Okay, anyways, so Chapter 7 of 1 Samuel goes like this. Pretty much the prophet Samuel is trying to get Israel back on the track with God. Israel at that point was following other gods, other religions, doing what they wanted, worshiping idols. And Samuel was like, nope, this is it. I'm bringing you guys back to God. And so he was in pretty much a week of cleansing, making everyone destroy their idols, destroy any foreign gods, anything. And they were praying and fasting, and the Philistines were like, hey, this is a great opportunity to attack the Israelites because they are at a weak point. They don't know who they're going to follow at this point. They're trying to follow the God, but they haven't really been following him, so he's not going to protect them. So let's attack these guys, obliterate them from the face of the earth, and it'll be great. We don't have to worry about them anymore. Then Israel gets word of that the Philistines are going to attack them, and they go into mass chaos panic, actually. And what they do, they start packing their carts and loading up everything. And I just imagine Doug and Darlene packing in this moment. I don't know why, because Doug always comes and talks to me, so I'm getting him back. Anyways, Doug is like, Darlene! Oh, not, sorry, he's got a deeper voice. Darlene! Darlene, get the coffee maker! We gotta get out of here! And Darlene's like, I don't want to bring the coffee maker! I want to bring this picture! No, leave the picture! We'll grab it when we can! And they're just yelling back and forth. And this is like everyone. Everyone's just not Doug and Darlene, I think. Oh, goodness. Anyways, so it's not Doug and Darlene. Picture Doug and Darlene now. They're mass chaos. And then Samuel comes up and goes, guys, what are you doing? And then Israel's like, hey, wait, yeah, we're trying to follow God now. So if we're trying to cleanse ourselves and follow this God, maybe God will protect us. So they're all like, go to Samuel. Samuel, please cry out to God on our behalf. Just do your sacrifices and make God, it's funny to use make God save us in a way. And so Samuel, all calm, I just picture like the calmest person in the world, amidst chaos, just wandering through the crowd, and he gets to a certain point, and he's just like, all right, guys, I want you to calm down. Everyone's like, oh, my gosh, ah! They're running back and forth. He's like, okay. excuse me. And they're like, oh, what was that? And he's like, hey, watch this. And so he begins praying to God, and he does some sacrifices, and he's like, God, we know that you are who you say you are, and we know that you are going to protect us and deliver us from this. And God is like, you know it. You know it. And so they're praying and delivering, and God sends thunder and lightning, and surprisingly, thunder and lightning throws the Philistines into panic. They're like, what is this? I don't know why, because I just hide under my bed. I don't really do anything else besides when thunder and lightning happens. And so that throws them into chaos, into panic, and Israel ends up actually doing what the Philistines wanted to do to them. They end up slaughtering them, and they can live in peace again. And so after all that, Samuel takes a rock, and he places it between the place where they were sacrificing and getting right with God, and to the point where the Philistines were going to attack them. And it's and so in between that, the two places, Mizpah and Shen, he places a rock. It's funny, they place this rock. And he places it down, and he calls it Ebenezer. And Ebenezer means, thus far the Lord helped us. And so the word Ebenezer comes from the Hebrew word Eben Ha'ezer, which simply means stone of help. When the writer of Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing, Robert Robinson, wrote his lyrics, he wrote the word Ebenezer with the phrase, here by thy great help I've come. And Ebenezer, then, is simply a monumental stone set up to signify the great help that God has granted us. So the next time you sing about raising your Ebenezer, you will be able to sing with an understanding that you are acknowledging God's help in your life. So now I'm going to take you to Joshua chapter 3, verses 14, all the way to chapter 4, verse 9. It may seem like a lot, but it's not really. And it actually describes into the whole monument understanding, I guess. And so I read it like this. So when the people broke camp to cross the Jordan, the priest carrying the Ark of the Covenant went ahead of them. Now the Jordan is at flood stage during all of harvest, yet as soon as the priests who carried the ark reached the Jordan and their feet touched the water's edge, the water from upstream stopped flowing. It piled up in a heap a great distance away at a town called Adam in the vicinity of Zarethan, while the water flowing down into the Sea of the Arabah, which is the Dead Sea, was completely cut off. So the people crossed over opposite Jericho. The priests who carried the ark of the covenant of the Lord stopped in the middle of the Jordan and stood on dry ground, while all of Israel passed by until the whole nation had completed the crossing on dry ground. When the whole nation had finished crossing the Jordan, the Lord said to Joshua, choose 12 men from among the people, one from each tribe, and tell them to take up 12 stones from the middle of the Jordan, from right where the priests are standing, and carry them over with you, and put them down at the place where you stay tonight. So Joshua called together the 12 men he had appointed from the Israelites, one from each tribe, and said to them, go over before the ark of the Lord your God into the middle of the Jordan. Each of you is to take up a stone on his shoulder according to the number of tribes of the Israelites, to serve as a sign among you. In the future, when your children ask you, what do these stones mean? Tell them that the flow of the Jordan was cut off before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. When it crossed the Jordan, the waters of Jordan were cut off. The stones are to be a memorial to the people of Israel forever. So the Israelites did as Joshua commanded them. They took 12 stones from the middle of the Jordan according to the number of tribes of Israel, as the Lord had told Joshua, and carried them over with them to their camp, where they put them down. Joshua set up the 12 stones that had been in the middle of the Jordan at the spot where the priests who carried the Ark of the Covenant had stood, and there they are to this day. So it brings me to my first point in my sermon, and it's simply put as, we face a lot. And if we read Joshua chapter 3, verses 14 and 15, it says, so when the people broke camp to cross the Jordan, the priest carrying the Ark of the Covenant went ahead of them. Now the Jordan is at full flood stage during the harvest. Yet as soon as the priests who carried the Ark reached Jordan and their feet touched the water's edge, the water from upstream stopped. So up to this point, the Israelites, under the leadership of Moses, came from Egypt, crossed the Red Sea into the desert, made it to the promised land, got kicked from the promised land, wandered the desert for 40 years, and God provided for them food, water, many things. He helped them to defeat their enemies while they wandered. And now, due to circumstances, Joshua is their leader, well, mainly because Moses had passed away, but Moses, due to some circumstances in his life, was not allowed to enter the promised land. And during the whole time, from when they exited Egypt, a pillar of fire and a pillar of cloud guided the Israelites all through. And up to this point, until they reached the Jordan with Joshua, The pillars of fire and cloud had left them, but not for the reasons for the fact that God didn't want to lead them anymore. It was for the fact that the Ark of the Covenant now possessed the presence of God, and it was constantly with them in this, I want to say container, but that sounds kind of bad, in this monument for them. So as we see this as things we face, that the Israelites had now come to the banks of the Jordan, and the Jordan is at peak season. Like, this thing is overwhelming flood stage almost, because the snow is melting from the Lebanon mountains, and as well as it was pretty much spring, it was harvest. So things were, it was raining, it was flooding, and it must have been a torrent of power. Like, watching it, have you guys, some of you guys have probably been to Niagara Falls or seen pictures or videos of it. That thing is massive, and the water going over the falls creates so much energy and power. I kind of picture that as the Jordan is, they're standing on the banks going, how are we going to cross this? And so with that water, we see it as things we face. The water represents the things that are almost bad in our lives. We face the river both at flood season and, I guess, dry season, non-flood season. There are times when in your life that it feels like you can easily cross the situation or problem in your life when the water is only, say, up to your ankles or up to your knees or your waist, and you find it very easy to cross over and, I guess, finish your problem with ease. And then there are times in our lives when we're stuck in the middle of the water and all of a sudden just floods. There's a big wave and it's over your head and it feels like you're drowning in this issue and you don't know what to do and you cry out to God to save you. I find those are the times where I find myself crying to God the most, when the water seems above my head, when I can't fix the problem and people around me can't fix the problem and I just feel overwhelmed and it feels like this thing will never go away, that I'm drowning. And so there's a situation in my life, Elisa and I's life, that brings to attention. I call it the summer of trouble. This was the summer, we got married in May, and so it was the summer following that. And I was starting my internship early at my church back at home, just so I could get to know the youth a lot better and, I guess, get fitted in before I had to go full-fledged into all my schoolwork and everything. But July, I was having a great time. I was doing summer programs with the youth and some of the junior youth and everything. And we were home one day, and my mom came up and like, well, that's kind of, why does my mom come? Like, sometimes she'll visit me, but she has like gifts in her hand or something. This time she didn't have a gift. And so, not like I don't like her not to come without a gift, but it was a little different. It's so bad. Anyways, and so, what happened was she came up and said that my grandma had passed away, actually, not even an hour ago. And they went to go find her, and they couldn't get into her place. And so she eventually got a key, went into her place, and found out that she passed away. And that was very hard. That was my last grandparent. I don't have any more grandparents left, except for married into Lisa's side. I now have three more? Damn. Sorry, I had to think about that. Three more. But on my side, I have no more grandparents. And it was very hard. I don't like losing people in general. I don't think anyone likes losing people. And so that was a hard one to deal with in July. But it wasn't over in July yet. There was a time when I was taking golf lessons with my father-in-law, and we were about to start our golf lessons. We were really excited, and he got a phone call, and everything just changed. We ended up rushing home to Elisa's parents' house and found out that her uncle had passed away very suddenly. He was quite a young age, 40, and he passed away. And so adding to that, we're like, I just lost my grandparent, now I lose an uncle. This is ridiculous. I don't understand why this happened to us. And so we're trying to deal with that. We're trying to understand what's going on. We don't know why we have to go through this. We're trying to find reasons, trying to make ourselves feel a little better. And then I started to go to classes for my fourth year, as well as do an internship. So I left Elisa for a week to do a module class. And I had about a two-week deadline to finish everything right after that class, and it was just very hectic for me. But I came home, and Elise was like, Andrew, I want a kitty. And I'm like, a kitty. We have one. We brought my cat that I had for about 14 years, and I loved my cat. It was so cuddly and everything, but apparently didn't cuddle with Elisa enough. So she's like, I want a kitty. I'm like, okay, we will go take a look. And we all know that when you say we'll go take a look, it means you're coming home with one. So we went, and I'm like, hey, remember, we're just looking. She's like, okay. We go in this room full of cats. She's looking over there. She's like, oh, these are so cute. And then she found a little orange one, and she's like, Andrew. Andrew. I'm like, no, we got to wait. We got to wait. And so she picked it up and immediately started snuggling with her. She's like, Andrew, Andrew. And I'm like, no, we have to wait. She's like, here, hold it. I'm like, oh, man. So needless to say, we forked over the money and got a cat that day. Anyways, and so what does having a cat have to do with the summer of trouble? Is that the fact that we got the cat, and not even 2 weeks later, it started to get sick. It would not leave the couch. It was curled up, and it just, its breathing was not doing very well. And so being on an internship kind of salary, I don't make a lot, and Elisa was doing her best to provide, so we weren't making a lot of money to take this thing to a vet, but I had a little bit of money, so we took it to the vet once, and they said, it just seems to be like a cold, so we'll give you these vitamins, we'll give you these special foods. If it doesn't improve, come see us again in about 3 days or so. And so we took it home, and we had high hopes for this cat, because we had fallen in love with it. And so we started feeding it, its special medicine and everything, but it was not improving, and within 2 days, it seemed to get worse, and so Elisa ended up phoning the 24-hour emergency and going in, and we had to leave it overnight, and then, so that was a Saturday. The next day, I was preaching my very first sermon, kind of ever, in a church, at our home church, and so I was praying for that. I was a little overwhelmed with that. I was overwhelmed with my schoolwork. I was overwhelmed with the situation at hand, and the summer was going on. I was just not having a good time, and then Elisa went with her mom that morning with the cat, and they found out that the cat had leukemia, and so they ended up putting it down, and so that added to another summer of trouble. And so, like, the first question is, everything that we love dies. I know that seems pretty harsh, but it felt that way. Like, everything that we love is dying around us. We can't touch anyone, can't start to like anyone, because we are just bad, bad for everyone. And so at that moment, it felt like the floodwaters were above our heads, that I was drowning in trouble, that I had no idea what to do, and I was exhausted with everything else that was going around, and it was hard. And so this leads into my second point. It says, why do we need a monument? It's found in Joshua chapter 3, 16 to 17. And I know you guys are kind of wondering, why did I tell you all these troubles? Aren't you supposed to be talking about good things that make us happy and want to love God all the more? This will bring you to the point where you love God all the more, but I have to explain this just so it kind of makes it real. And so Joshua 3, 14, 4 to 9. Chapter 4 to 9, we are remembering that a monument is something that is placed by the individual to be reminded of something great that has happened. In this case, in chapter 3, 16 to 17, God is remembered. So chapter 3, verse 16 to 17 says this, the water from the upstream stopped flowing. It piled up in a heap a great distance away at a town called Adam in the vicinity of Zarethan, while the water flowing down to the Sea of the Arabah, which is the Salt Sea, was completely cut off. So the people crossed over opposite Jericho. The priests who carried the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord stood firm on the dry ground in the middle of the Jordan while all Israel passed by until the whole nation had completed crossing. A key part in these two verses is the fact that the priests are carrying the Ark. They're bringing God's presence with them, and the fact that they stood firm in the middle of the Jordan. I can't imagine being there when first stepping in, you're like, ooh, it's kind of cold, and all of a sudden, it just disappears. You're like, whoa, it was cold and now it's dry. And now we just see a pile of water over there. I wonder if it's still kind of moving, you know? And you're just like, I wonder if that's going to fall on us sometime and crush us. I bet there was some doubt there. But God's presence kept the water parted. It kept it from coming back at them and crushing them. So this was a big part to test the faith of the priest, as well as to test the faith and trust of the Israelites that were crossing. The waters would literally be over their heads if God had let the water go. So it was a bold step into God's presence, into the awesome plan that he had for them. It was also a faith builder. What small faith they had to step into the Jordan was now being built up by the dry ground that was all around them. They were to fear no evil going into the promised land. If the God of the Israelites could stop a raging river, I'm sure that he could do something for the problems that were ahead of them. They were assured of God's presence. And it's funny that they kind of doubted, because the Jordan River is not as big as the Red Sea. and the past generations had crossed over on the Red Sea, and they had seen that God provided water out of a rock in the desert. They had seen manna fall from heaven. When they wake up, they're like, I have food. I don't have to worry about that. And yet, as this new generation walks to this edge, they fear it. It is as if the older generation stopped telling them about the greatness of what God had done for them. So, in our lives as well, in the moments and times the waters above our head, we need to trust God and see the amazing things that he can and will do, to watch your faith build all the more as you cross on dry ground amidst your troubles, to constantly know that God's presence is with you and that you do not need an Ark of the Covenant to prove that God is there. It is in these moments that the monuments in our lives are built. So back to the summer of trouble. It is hard to build a monument over the fact of death. I mean, you don't want to build a monument that reminds you of death. It's something no one wants to remember. But there are things that I can pull from those situations now that I can see as a monument, seeing that God has certainly been there and has walked us through it. In the case, in the regard of my grandmother's passing, I've seen my uncle who chose to leave God and to abandon his faith many, many years ago, had now come to my mom asking questions about his faith. And the fact that his depression was leaving, and the fact that he was actually starting to become happy, the fact that he gave my mother a hug after the funeral was a big step, because he never showed emotion. And we see that as a monument that God has been working on my uncle. I know it's a horrible situation, but there's good things that has come out of it. It seemed a little bit harder to find a monument out of the fact of Elisa's uncle passing. It was sudden. It was hard to deal with. The whole family just shrunk into, despair. But as we see it, though, during the funeral, the family all came together. They didn't care about getting time off work. They didn't care about things. They just knew that they had to be together. And so they made any means necessary to get there, to be with their family. And as well as afterwards, I find that they are constantly in contact with one another. They are constantly visiting each other more times than not. I see as a monument as a family has been built together once again. And it's very hard to see at the very beginning, but as we look back in our memories and in our spiritual walk, we see that God has never left us, but rather his presence has been building the dry ground for us when the water seems above our head. And so it brings me to my third point. It says, what is your monument? We heard of Samuel placing a rock, calling it his Ebenezer, where God has done something great. We see that Joshua is taking stones out of the water and placing to make a monument. And so we ask you, what is your monument? And so we read in Joshua chapter 4, 1-9, and it says this, when the whole nation had finished crossing the Jordan, the Lord said to Joshua, choose 12 men from among the tribes of Israel and tell them to take up 12 stones from the middle of the Jordan from where the priests are standing and carry them over with you and place them to where you're going to stay tonight. So Joshua called together 12 men ahead of time and appointed them to pick up these stones from the middle of the Jordan. And so I'm going to summarize it because it's pretty long in there. These 12 men, all appointed by Joshua, went into the bed, the dry ground where the priests were still standing. I wonder how the priests felt. It's like, man, we're still holding this. We just want to get across. But I think that was a huge faith builder for them because they had to stay there entire time while people crossed. But anyways, they had to stay there even though people had crossed because 12 more people were going to come back. And so these 12 men had to go into the Jordan and where the priests were standing, pick up 12 stones. And these weren't like little tiny stones. They were as heavy as these people could lift. And so they were lifting big stones onto their shoulders. And I bet they were probably a lot stronger than me, so they could probably lift like close to like 100 pounds each or something. And so they picked up these stones and they brought them to Joshua and brought them to the place where they're going to stay. And there, Joshua made a monument. And he made a monument to remind people of what God had done that day. And it was supposed to serve a purpose that was going to stay there for many, 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 many years to come. That the children of the next generation would come up and go, what are these stones? Why are they all piled here? Why are there 12 stones exactly? What does this all mean? And it was going to give an opportunity for the older generation to go, let me tell you an awesome story. That God had delivered us, that he brought us across on dry land. Even though we were fearful, God came through. And so I want you guys to remember how an Ebenezer is a monument built by the person in whom God showed something or did something awesome for, and they wanted to be reminded of this. That is what Joshua was doing. He was building a reminder for what God had done that day. He parted the waters, and Israel crossed on dry ground. Their faith and trust were built all the stronger and rooted all the more in God. The memory was fresh in their mind, but Joshua knew that eventually they would forget. If we move forward into Judges, I'm not going to go there, but I'm going to give you, if you do move into Joshua and read Judges and read it, the reason why the Judges had to come was that Israel had fallen away. They stopped, they were not reminded of what God has done, and so they turned to other things that they thought were greater, the things that would make them prosper, and they were being rooted in everything but God. The monuments stopped working because they didn't build the monuments in their own lives, but rather left the monuments that were built physically and did not remember it. So my question for you guys is, what monuments do you have in your life that helps you to be reminded of what God has done for you? I'm not saying you guys have to pile stones like Joshua did. That'd be kind of different, having a big pile of stones in your front yard. But I guess people would ask you, so it would kind of work. But I asked you guys, what things have you guys built up in your lives that reminds you what God has done? Many days we forget what God has done and we simply rely on our own ways, and not until the next crisis, the next time that the waters over our heads, do we seek after God and we say, remember when you did this for me? Please come through again. Whereas what we simply need to be doing is be reminded every day, constantly, that God has brought us out of many things. Circumstances will arise, and not all circumstances will be good. Sad to say, there will be quite a bit of bad things that will arise. But my prayer is that you guys will be reminded of the greatness of God, and that your faith is ever more planted in the faith and perseverance of what he has done in your life. And so I'm going to finish my sermon off with this conclusion that leads into my second part next week, and it says this: unlike the commemorative pillar erected by Samuel, your Ebenezer, your stone of help, requires neither hammer nor chisel. You don't need to sit down and pen an eloquent song as a psalmist did either. To create your personal Ebenezer, all you need to do is mentally page through your spiritual memory and recall the many and varied victories God has given you. You might begin by remembering the gifts of life: parents, home, wealth, education, and family. Your memories could include the blessings of friends, livelihood, community, and maybe even nation. But especially remember certain events in your life, times when God turned what appeared to be disaster into an unexpected opportunity, or when he took you through your hardships so you could gain the gifts of maturity and wisdom. Your personal Ebenezer turns you away from fear, doubt, and disbelief, because you realize once again how many times in the past God has forgiven, protected, and healed you. In the form of the cross, your Ebenezer stands as a constant reminder that God has given you the victory over all victories. Through Jesus Christ, he has made you victorious over the eternal effects of sin, winning you the promise of eternal life with him. His cross, his stone of help for you, assures you that just as your sins of the past have been forgiven completely, so sins of today and tomorrow will be forgiven in the same way. Begin setting up your personal Ebenezer stone, and in your mind, write the record of your life, of your spiritual history, by naming specific people and recalling specific events. You will see God's hand at work and recognize his compassionate love that has brought you through to this very day. So worship team, if you'd like to come up. I think we're actually singing Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing. So, now you guys know what Ebenezer means in the second verse. So that'd be awesome.